welcome to Unjustly Maligned, the show for people who go against the grain. We seek to rehabilitate overlooked, ignored, derided, and just plain hated contributions to pop culture. Movies, novels, music, comic books, video games, whatever. If everyone hates it, we'll find someone who loves it and let them explain why you should too. I'm your host, Anthony Johnston, and my guest today is a writer and musician who was one of the founding members and for many years editor-in-chief of Coil House, the alternative culture magazine. Musically, she's worked with the Dresden Dolls, the Walkmen, Beats Antique, and more, and in recent years has taken up film scoring, including the narrative of Victor Carlock. She even provided violin parts for the Nickelodeon series The Marvelous Misadventures of Flapjack. Oh, and she also plays theremin. Of course she does. It is my absolute pleasure to welcome to the show Meredith Yiannos.
Hi, it's great to be here.
Okay, this is something that we are both going to nerd out over heavily, I feel. So let's get straight into it. Tell us what you've chosen and then give us some context around its release, its reception upon release, why it is maligned and why you think those people are dead wrong.
Okay, so I chose the 1984 David Lynch directed Dune science fiction film. And I chose it for, oh God, so many reasons. So many. Starting from a very early age, actually. I first saw this film, I would say I was somewhere between maybe 10 and 12. Mm-hmm. Can't tell you exactly when. And it had a it permanently scarred me in the best possible way. And I, you know, I revisit it from time to time. I think I've probably watched this movie no less than 30 or 40 times mm-hmm. over the course of my life. Probably more. I have no shame in, like, maybe a little shame admitting that. But I adore this hot, beautiful, seething mess of a film. And I will knife fight in a Byzantine chamber of law, anyone that tells me that this movie has no place in the cultural dialogue, because it very much does.
So you say 10 to 12. I'm going to guess that you saw it on VHS.
I did. I saw it on VHS. I really shouldn't have. my dear friend Katie Schatz, holler to Katie Schatz, who I haven't seen since I was probably about 15. She had an older brother, and her older brother was a sci-fi nerd, and there was a slumber party. Dune ended up in the TV very late at night.
At a slumber party?
At a slumber party for soccer. For a bunch of us were on a soccer team together, these girls, and everyone was asleep. Well, you know, maybe a few of us were awake, but they definitely fell asleep very quickly. within I'd say the first half hour. I was transfixed, however, and just utterly, like, it blew my mind. It blew my tiny mind. And it was one of those situations where, you know, when you're little, when you're a very little creature, and you know you're watching something you're not supposed to.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You
yeah.
know you're not supposed to be watching some giant man floating around with suppurating boils and these, you know, like vaginal monsters, and it was very clearly a no-no. But I couldn't figure out why in a lot of ways. And I wrote off the weirdness of it as, oh, I'm a kid. I'm not supposed to understand this.
Right.
That was sort of my idea of the movies. Like, oh, well, you know, a lot of this doesn't make any sense, but that's just because I'm little. But no, apparently the New York Times review said something like, you know, a lot of the characters in this film are psychic, and they, in turn, are the only people that could understand, you know, the plot. The rest of us have no idea what the hell is going on.
I think that's a little unfair, considering those same psychic characters also tell you the plot with their thoughts right? as you are watching the movie.
With their awkward over, yeah, overdubs. Yeah. Good old Princess Irulan, bless her heart, trying to help us get through it.
So had you heard of the movie at all before you watched it?
I did, and it's funny. I don't know if you're aware, but this movie was marketed as a kind of Star Wars type vehicle. Yeah. So children who, again, really have no business being exposed to something like this, you know, under the age of 15, and it's just like, ooh, bad touch, really bad touch. But I had heard about it. There were action figures. I remember seeing Fremen action figures in, like, in the local toy shops. Wow, really? And yeah, I mean, it was, there was an activity book series, which we're definitely going to need to talk about at some point.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it was definitely, this is around the same ballpark era as Tron. Shout out to Will Wheaton. That was a great, great episode for you guys. And I got the sense that they just didn't know how to properly market this thing. And the marketing team was just earnestly very dead set upon making it a kind of Star Wars moneymaker.
Yeah.
And yet it was so inappropriate for children. It was not age appropriate. Like, you can even tell within the various activity books, like oh my God, why am I looking at a coloring book page of, you know, the dead Duke, like, who's just, what? There are corpses. Why is there a coloring book corpse? Well, I mean, obviously that's awesome.
Right. It's awesome, but it's also what the hell? The source material is not, you know, Dune is not exactly a favorite with the kids, you know?
No, it's not. And yet, that's the thing. I was exposed to the film first, and then I went and I read the books. And I thought then, and I still think, you know, David Lynch did the best he could. I mean, that is a sprawling, ridiculous narrative, and there's so many shades of gray. It's like the opposite of C.S. Lewis's books, or the Tolkien series, or Star Wars. Yeah, there's no clear cut good and evil, in the same way that those films have that, and that was really compelling to me, and still is, and is still why I think, you know, if I had to choose between watching the Star Wars films and Dune, I would be hard pressed. And I like the Star Wars movies, but there's something more specifically just twisted and frightening and deep to me, which, you know, people are rolling their eyes, I'm sure, and laughing, but no, really, like, they took a stab at making an incredibly morally ambiguous blockbuster sci-fi movie. And, you know, what they came up with is just a giant eyebrow raiser for all of us.
And with giant eyebrows.
Yes! Oh, my God!
It's, I mean, let's be honest. Also, you know, I know you. The listeners maybe don't. I know you. This is also just more you.
Oh, it's so bio-horror. I'm a fan. You know, yeah, Cronenberg, one of my favorite filmmakers.
Exactly.
Classic 80s Carpenter, same deal. Possession. Did you ever see that movie, Possession? Not the Gwyneth Paltrow vehicle. The old, it was shot in Berlin. It has Carlo Rambaldi, the same guy that did all of the crazy creature design for Dune.
Oh, right.
Yeah, that movie. Like, yes, this is sort of like the blockbuster popcorn version of that. And, you know, the only thing that could make Dune better is having Isabella Gianni in it, really.
She improves everything, yes. I hadn't seen this in years, actually, before watching it, you know, in preparation for the show, but I had seen it many times when I was younger, because I used to watch it on VHS. I first saw it on VHS like you. I was 12 when the movie was released, so I probably saw it when I was like 14, 15 from, you know, the local video shop, because it obviously, of course, would have been stacked amongst all the sci-fi movies, and that was the section of the video shop that we inhabited.
Yes.
I never read the books, but I have heard many people who love the books complain that this is a really bad adaptation. So it's interesting to hear you be more sympathetic and say, well, he kind of did the best he could.
He really did. You know, the thing that's clear is he got caught up in a huge Hollywood sausage factory machine type situation. You know, like, he was the golden child at that point in time. You know, he put out Eraserhead, and that was this huge underground cult favorite, and then The Elephant Man, and he was widely considered to be just this genius, like, weirdo, and which he is.
Well, I was going to say, plus ça change.
when it didn't work out with Jodorowsky, and, you know, yes, I saw the documentary that recently came out, Jodorowsky's Dune, and I loved it, and I lament that that version didn't happen, of course, and we'll talk about that again, I bet. But you know, I really do think that Lynch did the best he could. I get the sense even he has sort of tried to distance himself from the whole thing. I don't think he's...
Oh, yeah, definitely.
He's not particularly proud of this.
Yeah. No, he won't talk about it in interviews.
No.
He doesn't want to discuss it, which I think is a shame because...
It's like the day the clown cried for him.
I really think this movie is a lot better than people gave it credit for at the time, certainly, and that most people remember. Like I say, it had been a long time since I had seen it, but I remember watching and enjoying it many times when I was younger. And as the movie progressed, as I was watching it, I realized, wow, actually, no, I really do love this movie. Like, so much of it is in my mind, you know?
Yeah, indelibly.
As every scene as it was happening, I was going, oh, yeah, I remember this bit. Oh, yeah, I remember this bit. Incredible.
I mean, the acting talent they got, the design talent, the costuming, there was so much money being poured into this thing.
It was a $40 million budget, which in 1984 was a hell of a lot of money.
Obscene. And I think that's only just the Lynch version. Of course, there were other pockets of money that got like lost when they were trying. Yeah, it's unbelievable. And it's gorgeous. Like every shot is gorgeous. There is not a single ugly shot in that entire film, except maybe some of the sandworm shots where they're against the green screen or the blue screen. Those are pretty painful to watch, but also really, to me, delightful. That's a kind of nostalgia I don't mind indulging from time to time, watching, you know, poor Stilgar try to look dignified on that blue screen.
Well, and that's, you know, that's like Ray Harryhausen's skeletons in Jason Rodriguez or something. It's like, of course it's primitive. You don't care. It was the technology of the time, whatever.
But it still holds up. Yeah, I mean.
Well, and what amazed me was how much, again, like, as I was rewatching it, how much of this movie has made it into pop and SF culture.
Totally.
And become, you know, a part of the fabric of the culture. You know, Sting as a killer, obviously derided at the time. I think, you know, I can imagine. Fear is the mind killer. I mean, that's a phrase that people actually say now.
Yes.
Walk without rhythm. There was a Fatboy Slim record quoting that line, for heaven's sake. You know,
that video too with Christopher Walken.
That's the one. Yeah, yeah.
So good.
It's you know, the psychic guns, the holographic armor. Wait for my brother, Baron.
Wait for my brother.
That's much better than mine. Just fantastic stuff. Like, it's so many memorable scenes and set pieces and characters. And as you say, the actual talent on screen is amazing.
Soon we leave for Arrakis. Arrakis is real. The Harkonnens are real.
Dr. Yui. Do you have any information on the worms of Arrakis?
I've obtained a film book of a small specimen, only 125 meters long.
Only?
There have been documented sightings of worms as large as 450 meters in the deep desert. That's far from where we'll be in Arrakeen. The desert belt and the south polar region are marked forbidden.
How do the Fremen survive there?
We don't know much about the Fremen. They live in the deep desert, some of them in the cities. They have blue within blue eyes.
Oh, the eyes. Yes. Saturation of the blood by the spice, Melange. Could the spice affect us in other ways?
Many dangers exist on Arrakis. For one, the Harkonnens would not have given up their Chome Company contract so easily.
The Harkonnens are our enemies, yes. But behind them, I suspect, is the Emperor.
You'll make a formidable duke.
Oh my god, that cast. Max von Sydow? Hello? Brad Dourif? Jose Ferrer as the Emperor? Linda Hunt? Oh my god, that was my introduction to Linda Hunt. I love her so much for so many reasons. And
Jürgen Prochnow? I love him.
Kyle MacLachlan, you know.
Before we get to him, I was going to say, how could we forget Patrick Stewart?
Right? What? Gurney. Oh my God. And Jack Nance is in that.
Yes. And then, of course, Kyle MacLachlan, the supernaturally beautiful Kyle MacLachlan.
Oh, he was so beautiful.
again, until rewatching it, I don't think I'd quite clicked. Like, oh my God, he really was a beautiful young man, wasn't he?
He was exquisite. He and Sean Young look more like biological twins, like, than they do a couple. But I mean, they're both so exquisite. Yeah, and yeah, Kyle MacLachlan. It's really incredible, those early movies with him. You know, I mean, Blue Velvet too.
Yes, yes,
incredible.
Of course,
yeah. Yeah, there's just a lot of really exquisite eye candy across the board in that film.
Yeah,
Dean Stockwell.
Oh yes, like, yes, Dean Stockwell. Of course.
It just goes on and on. Like the people involved, just purely in the acting pool, was just unbelievable.
Amazing, yeah. And I mean, talking about that makes me think. If you look at the cast list that Jodorowsky assembled for his supposed version, very, very different, including his own 12-year-old son was going to play Paul Atreides.
Amazing. It would have been amazing too.
Well, I'm sure it would. I'm not as hot on Jodorowsky as many people, to be perfectly honest with you.
I am hot and bothered as heck, always, for that man.
I am. Like, if people think that Lynch strayed too far from the books...
What were they...
I am 99.9% confident that a Hodder version would have blown their gaskets, you know?
But this is the thing, and this is what I love about the Jodorowsky Dune documentary, talking about how that would have utterly transformed the cultural landscape in ways that we can't even possibly imagine. If he had managed to make it happen, which, I'm sorry, in this particular universe, it was never going to happen.
Right,
it was
right.
just never going to work out, unfortunately. But if it had... You know, it would have predated Star Wars. It would have likely changed the course of Spielberg's career, of Lucas's career. It's amazing to contemplate and think about that. But unlike a lot of the people that wanted to see that, I love what we did end up with. And
right, right.
So I'm okay.
Didn't he also have Mobius doing concept work?
He did. He had Mobius doing concept work, and that is actually how Mobius ended up working on Alien, I believe. And
Mobius worked on Alien?
Mobius worked a little bit on Alien, I believe. And
wow, I didn't
definitely
know that.
Definitely, even though that movie didn't happen, the Jodorowsky version, it did. Have you seen the documentary?
No, but I know that a lot of the people who didn't work on Alien, like Dan O'Bannon and stuff, then went on to use some of the work they'd done for it.
Darkstar, so. rest in peace, man. That guy.
Oh, Darkstar, yeah, man.
But I would highly recommend checking that out. Even if you're not a Jodorowsky fan, just learning the ways in which that unmade film affected sci-fi culture and mainstream
indirectly,
films.
Indirectly,
via osmosis. It's great.
But this was. I always got the feeling with this movie that it was too weird for the mainstream, but
it
not
was.
Weird enough for the fans. Does that make sense?
It does. It's, God, it's just one of those. And again, I think that might be one of the reasons why I love it so much. I am a big fan of lonely, sad creatures that sort of wander the edges of other things, kind of feeling out of place.
And David Lynch is certainly that.
he really is. Well, the thing that's so funny about David Lynch making a film like this is he's actually such a suburban visionary, and people don't talk about that. They don't talk about the fact that all of his ideas come from normalcy, these monstrous, grotesque sort of mythologies of normalcy, of normal Americana. And that's why his stuff is so disturbing, because that's what he's pushing against. So for him to push off so hard that he's in deep space with giant floating third stage guild navigator turds and, you know, like a little tiny 5-year-old preternaturally intelligent girl with a Gom Jabbar like killing knife in a killing field and their bodies on fire behind her while she throws her head back in ecstasy in slow motion and et cetera and et cetera. Well,
and the heart plugs and...
The heart plugs! Oh, God, you sicko, David Lynch. That was all him.
Was that him?
That was all him. That did exist in the narrative of the Herbert film.
For years, that was one of the most disturbing disturbing things I'd seen.
Oh God!
You know, in cinema, like, I mean, you can, yeah, sure, you know, zombies and vampires and horror movies and slasher films and stuff, but those heart plugs.
Oh, so bad! And the
just
cat
the
milking
concept of it.
Oh my God! Everything the Harkonnens are terrifying. And you know, one thing a lot of people criticize the Harkonnen stuff. They talk about how, you know, the Baron Harkonnen is so much more subtle and nuanced and intelligent and frightening in the books. And I see their point, but I still think that they got across just the brutality and the complete and utter just nihilism of being a non-noble Harkonnen in that world. Oh, so spooky.
Well, and the character is intelligent. He's, you know, yes, he's brutal and animalistic, but he's not thick.
Well, he's a bit slapstick in the film, isn't he? It's pretty slapstick.
It's
I mean,
broad performance, shall we say.
Raban! Raban! I place you in charge of Arrakis. It's yours to squeeze, as I promised. I want you to squeeze and squeeze and squeeze! Give me spice! Drive them into utter submission. Do not show the slightest pity or mercy. Never stop. Go. Go! Show no mercy!
Nick Baron!
But there's a really memorable parts of the movie as well. The Baron is a really memorable character.
He really is. He is. I am happy with this version again. Like, I'm almost just kind of playing devil's advocate to point out, I totally get why other people roll their eyes so hard they might as well be space junk. Like, just like, I get that. I do. It's just, for whatever reason, I don't mind it. I love it. It does it for me.
Yeah. No, I totally get that. Same here. As I say, it wasn't until watching it back that I realized, like, oh, wow, no, actually, I really do love it. Like, there's not a scene in this movie that I don't enjoy.
Right.
And when I realized, and this is a bit like a while ago, I talked about Gremlins 2.
Yes!
Rick Shansky. And while I was re-watching Gremlins 2, it had been, again, years since I'd watched it, and I suddenly realized how many lines I had stolen from that movie. Like, just, I don't mean for my own work, I mean just in everyday life, things that I say that came from that movie. And the same here. I was suddenly,
it is by will alone I set my mind in motion, it is by the juice of Safu that thoughts require, etc, etc, etc. Yeah.
Or Big Ed from Twin Peaks, what's his name, Everett McGill.
Oh god, Stilgar,
I will take the boy man.
Perhaps these are the ones the Shaddat Mapes told us of.
I will take the boy man. He shall have sanctuary in my tribe.
I say that all the time, and I've almost forgotten that it came
the grunt.
From this movie.
Oh, the grunt.
Oh, they tried and died. You know, think just
they tried and failed.
So many lines from this movie that have
what's
become
in the box?
Part of my
pain.
Vocabulary.
Yes. Oh, no. I mean, that's the thing. Like, I told... flesh crisping. I have not said this. I was not here. Whatever that line is. Yeah, it's incredible. I'm not alone. We're not alone. I have a lot of friends that are diehards just like me. They all tend to be kind of, we're all sort of in the same, I think, age group, and we were exposed to it when we were children, long before we had any business watching something like
right,
it.
Right.
Because it was marketed to us to a degree.
Yep.
And so when I get together with, say, my friend Philip Broughton and I will, or Ed Zittrin, we'll talk about this a lot. This film and it's definitely just indelibly marking all of us. And yeah, I wonder, you know, so many of the set designers, Giorgio Desideri, and again, I mentioned Carlo Rambaldi, the creature designer, the costuming, all of these people definitely went on to make really beautiful things later, but there was, I think it was a pinnacle for a lot of their careers in terms of just how immaculate the look of it was, the aesthetic. It was such a completely...
Oh, it looked like nothing you'd seen before, yeah.
Not at all. Yeah. And it's still, there are definitely films that have tried to emulate it and have failed. You know, I'm thinking of the Pitch Black series.
Oh, I like Pitch Black.
No, I like some of that stuff. the Chronicles of Riddick is a little bit much for me. I can't really. that is
much more Dune-like, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, that's true. Actually. Yeah.
It is very.
Talking about set designers and stuff, and earlier talking about crossover and influence of people who worked on earlier versions, I hadn't noticed until I watched it this time how Geiger-ish the Atreides palace is.
Oh, well, absolutely. I mean, Geiger was such a huge part of the Yudorowski team.
Okay.
Geiger designed all of the Harkonnen stuff for the Yudorowski Dune, and they definitely ripped that off.
Right.
Like, they weren't using him anymore. I don't think so, anyway. I could be wrong. We should check
out. I don't think he worked on the Lynch version, no. But yeah, as I was watching it, I was like, "What? That looks really Geiger. Like, really Geiger, complete with, you know, suggestively shaped ovals on the walls and things."
it's dirty. Oh my God. Yeah. Definitely Geiger's influence is there.
Are the weirding modules part of the books? And regular listeners will have to, I'm sure most of you have read Dune and you're laughing at me now, but I have never read it, so I don't know. Are they part of the books?
I'm not sure. I'm pretty sure David Lynch, that was one of the things that he came up with that was just his idea.
Like, really?
Yeah.
Because I love those. That is one of the most fascinating pure sci-fi concepts in here for me.
Move back.
This is part of the weirding way that we will teach you. Some thoughts have a certain sound, that being the equivalent to a form. Through sound and motion, you will be able to paralyze nerves, shatter bones, set fires, suffocate an enemy or burst his organs. We will kill until no Harkonnen breathes Arrakeen air.
It was him trying to make there are so many ideas in the books that are intangible, and I think that was one of the ways in which David Lynch was trying desperately to give us an anchor, to give us something physical to hang on to. I believe, yeah, I mean, the killing words, that's all in the referenced in the books, if I'm clear on that. But yeah.
But channeling the killing words through a device.
Yeah, I think the weirding modules were one of his.
Oh, wow.
I know for a fact that the Bene Gesserits weren't bald.
Oh really? Oh.
No, they weren't.
Again, some one of the sort of most striking parts of the movie.
Oh, I love it. No, a good friend of mine and I want to be Bene Gesserits for Halloween this year.
Awesome.
We're gonna, yeah. Bob Ringwood, he's the costume designer, and if I recall correctly, I think he worked on the original, the 1989 Batman.
Oh wow! Right. Okay.
So yeah, he made the bald, you know, the third stage guild navigator, like the giant fetus, scrotum, vagina, what, I don't even know, like Jerusalem cricket from hell. that is definitely something that the Lynch crew came up with.
Right, yeah, that is crazy. You know, in fact, that actually reminded me of Cronenberg.
Oh, very much so. That's Carlo Rambaldi all over again. Carlo Rambaldi is the designer of E.T.
Right.
That's another story. That's a documentary I would love to make. The documentary where Rick Baker talks about working on the original E.T. design and having it suppressed, and then they brought in Carlo Rambaldi to make that goofy E.T. design.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, that'll never happen. None of those guys ever want to talk about any of that stuff, but I've always been fascinated by that legend. It is a legend spoken of in hushed tones in the Hollywood makeup effects community.
Oh, wow.
And I've always been fascinated by that. Yeah, the Sadakar uniforms and... yeah, there's a great article by somebody over at Topless Robot where they talk about all of the Lynch injections, the cat milking. That was very much his idea.
Oh, right.
And the heart plugs, yes. And the Baron having that really perverted doctor that's got some sort of sexual fetish going on for the Baron's pustules.
You are so beautiful, my Baron. Your skin, love to me. Your diseases, lovingly cared for all eternity.
And then all, you know, all of the whispered inner monologue stuff that everyone gets so mad about, and I watch it and I think, yeah, no, this is great.
I must not fear. Fear is the mind killer. Fear is a little death that brings total obliteration. I will face my fear. I will permit it to pass over me and through me. I must not.
Could he be the one? Maybe. But will he be ours to control?
The furtive whispers to sort of try to convey this absurdly dense amount of expository information, right, about the world. How the hell else was he going to do it?
Well, and when psychic powers are such a big part of the story,
absolutely,
then, you know, like the idea that you are be able to hear the thoughts of somebody on screen, it's, I think that works really well. I never had a problem with that. I never understood why people thought that was, I mean, yes, some of the exposition itself is ham-fisted, but the concept I always thought was a really good idea. It's one of the few areas where I'm actually in favor of, like, inner monologue VO in a movie, because most of the time it doesn't work.
Right. Well, I mean, you look at the original theatrical release of Blade Runner with that awful narrative. Cold fish, that's what my wife called me.
Don't
just
make
so
me
bad. So bad. And, well, that's the version that I grew up watching. And
no,
then the director's cut came out and I was just so happy. There is a horrible 4-hour long version of this film where they tried to put in items that they thought would somehow make the film make more sense, and it's even more obfuscating. Like, it just makes it more confusing. So whatever editor was given I don't remember the name of the editor of this film. I think I may have blocked it out. But whoever they were, I hope they worked again. Kudos to them for trying to put together a Frankenstein monster, because it really was.
According to Wikipedia, it is Anthony Gibbs was the
Anthony
editor.
Ooh, it's an Anthony, holla!
And Anthony without an H as well, spelt the same way.
Nice!
Because it's a British thing. He's a British film and television editor with over 40 film credits.
Oh, good. Okay,
well,
I'm
Bonnie
glad.
And Clyde.
Oh, nice!
Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner, The Entertainer, The Knack and How to Get It.
Okay.
This is a man who's, yeah, I don't think he was hurting for work.
No. So clearly there were...
The door on the roof.
Right. Okay. So clearly top talent was involved in all of this. And it just didn't come together. Jodorowsky talks about how he blames the producers, the daughter of Dina De Laurentiis.
Well, and Lynch pretty much comes out and says that as well, doesn't he?
Yeah. That it was, that was what happened. Like, it was just, there was no rescuing it from the trajectory that she put it on, which is sad. You know, that's a bummer. But clearly everyone did the best they could with what they were dealing with.
It's funny that you mentioned Blade Runner, actually, because earlier when you were saying about how you discovered this movie, that's pretty much how I discovered Blade Runner.
Oh, yeah.
Not the slumber party, but it was it was shown late night on, like, BBC Two over here, you know, sort of starting at 11 p.m. or something. And I think I'd seen the poster, so I knew that it was Harrison Ford, and I knew it was sci-fi and he had a gun. That's enough for me. So
yep.
I set the VHS to record, and I would have been, that was before Dune. So Blade Runner came out 81, it was probably 84. So I'm going to say I was probably about 13 or something.
Yep, that's around how old I was when I saw it as well.
Yeah, and that was when I first saw, and yes, it was the theatrical cut, obviously, and even cut for TV, I think, at that
point. Oh, God. Oh, you missed out on Pris's tantrum, her death throes.
Right, but it was still enough to make me fall in love with the movie. And of course, now I own like every version and every
ditto.
Box set, and, you know.
I have the little plastic origami unicorn up on my windowsill, for sure.
Awesome.
Yeah, there were some amazing movies that came out around that time. And I bet there were a lot of people working on Blade Runner that worked on Dune as well, I'm guessing.
Yeah. But here's the thing that they share is density. And
yes.
You were talking about the amount of exposition that Lynch had to get across in this film. And absolutely, yes. You know, you to the point where the producers step in and go, yeah, we're going to have somebody actually, like, just tell Pete, tell the audience what's going on for the first couple of minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that clearly, I mean, I can't believe that the introduction by the Emperor's daughter, who only has one line in the actual movie.
What the F? That moment where she fades out and then she comes back and says, oh, yes, I forgot to tell you. What? Why? Yeah. Well, I don't understand, but I love it. I love that.
Right. But that's clearly not Lynch's... I refuse to believe that that was Lynch's idea, you know?
Maybe the fade out and fade back in was his idea. Who knows? That entire opening is so...
It's bonkers.
Completely weird. Well, that's the thing. I remember the first time I watched this film, I kept going, what is going on?
Right.
What the hell? And to this day, and again, I've seen it so many times now, I still do that. I still go, what the hell? And I, in a happy way, it still is not like anything else I've watched, and I've watched a whole lot of sci-fi.
Here's the thing. Imagine if you did the movie without the Emperor's Daughter doing the introduction and the voiceover, mm-hmm. and you were just kind of thrown into it.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder how that would have been. You know, how strange and confusing it would have all been then, even more so, you know?
Everyone's glazed over during her entire opening speech anyway. Like, nobody, there's no context for it. It's just this random, gorgeous woman in this vaguely Byzantine outfit, like, you know, going on and on about how beginnings are difficult times and all of these totally kind of obfuscating, long, polysyllabic names.
Yes. The names, yeah.
I mean...
What made me think of that was, a while ago, one of my favourite kids' movies, The Dark Crystal.
Me too!
I had a feeling it might be. I love that movie. I have the special edition DVD. I get it out every couple of years and rewatch it. Love
it's
it.
So good.
But a couple of years ago, I became aware of a different version, a different cut, with no exposition sort of voiceover at the start,
right.
And with the Skeksis voices.
Yes.
The original Skeksis, they just made noises.
Yeah, no, they just...
There was no English. So
right.
Though all those scenes, you just would have to judge purely by the puppetry and the acting. And I watched it. There's a very, very rough cut.
I've seen it too.
YouTube.
Somebody
right.
put it together on YouTube.
And it is incredible. It's amazing. And it is so... bewildering and bewitching, and you just think, if you know, much as I'm all for artistic purity, at the same time, if this had been released, there is no way that, you know, it would be as fondly remembered by people who saw it when they were kids
as it is.
You know,
it's really interesting. I remember reading somewhere that at the there was a screening with all of the producers and the high muckety mucks, and they sat in silence as the credits rolled on the original version.
Wow.
That had that going on, and they walked out.
Yeah.
They just walked out without saying a word to Henson or any of his people. And I can't imagine what that would be like. It's such a hard call, because I loved watching that version, by the way. That version
Dark
Crystal
is
amazing. But yeah, I mean, I think about how I just gobbled up everything, and like no piece of that animal was wasted. The Dark Crystal animal.
Yeah.
And it's kind of the same with Dune. Like, I haven't thrown any of that away.
Exactly. It's got that same sort of density where you know, yes, it's a compromise, but you mm-hmm. really do need somebody to draw you in and go, okay, look, this is the world. I'm just going to lay things out for you. Now, here you go, you know, off you go and enjoy the story.
I just feel like every time I watch the film, I Princess Irulan is just basically going wah 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 wah. Like, she might as well be making Skeksis noises at me. Like, it's useless. But I understand what they were trying to do. The whispered internal monologues, those things, those helped me.
Yes.
That helped me to understand. There's that heartbreaking moment where Thufir is thinking, you know, he's been captured and he's been completely degraded by the Harkonnens. And
yes.
There's that moment where he has his little moment of dignity.
All I can see is an Atreides that I want to kill.
fate.
No, no. Thufa's a Harkonnen now. Aren't you, Thufa?
My Duke, how I failed you.
Well, and he says, oh, my Duke, as
yes,
well. Like, which is
Duke.
That extra level of
love.
Pathos. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
And that stuck with me. There is empathy in that film that is not evident in a lot of big, schlocky, pew-pew Star Wars-style space epics. And in Dune, there is actually a lot of really subtle emotional content. Okay, maybe it's not subtle. Maybe it's not subtle at all. But I admire that. And that, again, that's something that I feel like I wish David Lynch would give himself and his team, I wish they would give themselves credit for that, because that was ballsy. That was really a gutsy thing to do.
Although, looking at it now from the perspective of, you know, the modern era, one thing that really stood out to me is how messed up the gender politics are.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, that's true with the Herbert books.
Again, I haven't read them, so.
Oh, well, it's really...
The Bene Gesserit are kind of presented as all-powerful, but they are basically just there to breed a savior who will then be stronger than all of them. So,
and then there's that awful line that Paul has where he's basically, you know, giving her a bitch slap at the end, you know, like, look into that place that you dare not look. You'll find me there staring back at you. That stuff. Yeah, the gender politics of this film are pretty rough. Then again, Alia, who...
She's pretty awesome.
Oh my God, Alia, all of the women of Dune, really. I mean, Sean Young, too. One of the only things about Blade Runner that drives me nuts is Sean Young's character, Rachel. I love Rachel, she's beautiful, but just the passivity and the... That was something that really kind of irked me at the time, and I mean, thankfully they had Pris and Zora,
right,
you know, balancing it out.
She's pretty passive in this as well, though. Her character in this doesn't really do anything.
She is. It's a bummer. I mean, but it's implicit that she could kick Paul's ass.
Right. They do. Right, but she has to literally say it. I would not have allowed you to harm my tribe. You know.
Yeah.
It's
exactly.
Like, they couldn't even bring themselves to show her kicking ass. I mean, it's a symptom of the times. Unfortunately,
yeah.
I don't think. I'm not trying to paint Lynch as a misogynist or anything. That's just...
Oh, well, you know, you wouldn't... There are a lot of people that make that argument and they have good reasons for it.
But it's... I don't think you could on the basis of this movie, because that's just what sci-fi movies especially were in the 80s. They
Absolutely.
Did have really dodgy gender politics.
But then again, you have this tiny 5-year-old child who kills Baron Harkonnen with her Gamja Bar and then frolics out in the killing field.
Yes.
You know, if there's anything that I took away from that film that just is never going to go away, it's that scene.
You're right. And she is the future.
Mm-hmm. And, and in the books too, Alia is clearly such a complete and utter badass on levels that none of the other characters can come close to.
Oh, really? Oh, okay,
it's tragic for her, but she's a badass. I mean, you know, and again, the shout-out mates, Linda Hunt, and, you know, these extremely powerful women in their own ways, women that have agency. You know, you have the shout-out mates, the Fremen insider, and she's tiny and invisible, no one notices her, and that's how she is able to save Paul's life. And you have, the Bene Gesserits are completely terrifying. And you know, their politics are awful, but they're these gorgeous, bald, completely alien creatures that are really strong and just, they're above it. They're just above it. They're like, we are on a sacred mission and we are more powerful than you could possibly imagine. And... You know, you can't touch us. Like that whole scene with the box of pain.
You
know, I could have another conversation just about the screwed up gender politics of so many of these movies, but especially this one.
Yeah.
And again, it's one of those things where I just let it go, which for me is not easy. But I can, because I just keep seeing Alia in the killing field.
Right. As you said, yeah, throwing her head back and laughing as slaughter takes place all around her, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, no, I mean, in the books, they talk about how People go out into the fields and slit the throats of anyone who's still alive. So that's what she's doing out there.
Oh, wow.
It's not explained. It's just alluded to. But yeah, she's out there in the fields making sure that she dispatches...
No Harkonnen left alive.
No. Wow. Yeah. The Emperor's men will die. Everyone dies. All of them. And I love that. And you know, I love Princess Irulan. I feel very sad for her in the Dune version. When I read the books later, I that was one of the things I lamented, that poor Princess Irulan doesn't get a little more screen time and expository. So she needed to be doing exposition for herself, like in addition to exposition for everybody else. It's just such a giant seething hot mess, and I love it.
Well, it is a mess, and it is giant. That's the thing. It is
like.
Right, so many sci-fi movies try to be epic in scope, but Dune is one of the few that actually is and feels it. It genuinely feels like massive, like
it
a
is
real,
so massive.
An old-fashioned David Lean style epic movie. You
oh,
know?
Absolutely, Golden Age. Like it is just insane. I mean, it has more in common with 2001 with Kubrick,
yes,
than it does with Star Wars.
If only the soundtrack had been a bit better
along those lines,
the soundtrack of 2001.
Oh, okay. Well, here's okay. I'm going to have to agree to disagree. That was the first time I ever heard Brian Eno.
Oh, that's right.
The
prophecy theme, doesn't he? Right.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Toto stuff is wretched, although...
Well, that's kind of what I'm...
I know. But it's so... That, too, is so completely... No. Like that soundtrack has played in the background through my entire life. I'm not going to divulge who, but like I knew I'd made a love connection when I was in Peccadillo's with someone, and there was that, you know, that moment of the unveiling of, you know, your anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You can cut this out if you need to, but. Shy allude references in bed. Come on. Okay.
Right.
With
wow. Okay.
with soundtrack, and then there's that scene you were talking about, the heart plug scene. I mean, as horribly over the top as that music is, it's like straight up, you know, the abominable Dr. Fibes level, like pathos there, and I love that. I love it. I don't mind it. But yeah, as a musician.
I just can't help thinking, I mean, you're right, the Eno theme is great.
Oh, it's
but
beautiful.
I just can't help thinking, like, imagine if somebody like Tangerine Dream had done the soundtrack for this.
Oh, come on. Okay, well, let's talk for a moment about Legend, shall we?
Of course, yes.
You know, if they could, it would have, if Tangerine Dream had done the soundtrack, it probably would have sounded quite a lot like that.
Yes, it probably would actually.
But that's one of those things. It's like, oh, I do, like Pink Floyd was going to do, and Magma, all of these psychedelic great musicians, all these bands, these prog psychedelic bands were going to do the Jodorowsky version. And I think it would have been amazing if they had hopped onto the Dune version. Instead of, you know, Toto, but I'm just gonna confess it. When I back in the day when you couldn't find, anything digitally, I paid something like $60 in the early '90s, which was a lot of money for a CD for a bootleg of the Dark Crystal soundtrack and for a bootleg of the Toto soundtrack from Dune.
Oh wow.
I at San Diego Comic-Con, there used to be a lot of tape trading and bootleg trading that happened. And, you know, I grew up in San Diego and I've been going to the con since I was little. And those were the things that I was hungry to have were, these obscure out of print, soundtracks. And so, you know, like I am very fond of the Toto soundtrack as well. And again, that's totally a nostalgia thing, but, I'll never forget the first time I heard the Brian Eno, prophecy. The first time it registered, it was the first time I watched it. And, you know, I'm sitting on this couch surrounded by sleeping soccer girls, like soccer team girls. And there's this totally unearthly music. And I was, you know, a couple years later, I discovered Another Green World and David Bowie and, you know, all of that stuff. And that was the first time I heard Brian Eno. And he has since become one of the most influential musicians on me. So,
Oh, well, and me too. Eno is God as far as I'm concerned, yeah.
The man
can do no wrong.
No.
I'm just sort of mentally, as we're getting towards the end of the movie, and I'm thinking about that big battle scene with Aaliyah. Oh, I didn't know it was Alicia Witt who played...
Yes!
Aaliyah. I never knew until I read the credits this time around, and I'm like, oh my goodness, because of course I've seen her in stuff since now as an adult.
Oh, she's fantastic. There's a great scene, I think it was on Conan O'Brien, where... he says, oh, I just want to show you my favorite work of yours or something. And he shows her a clip from Dune and she just laughs and hides her face. But yeah.
I know, but it's great.
It's so great.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
Oh, creepy. I doubt that was her voice. I'm guessing that's an
almost certainly not. Yeah. And it looks slightly dubbed as well, but she gets the facial expression.
Oh, totally.
She looks sinister.
Yeah. Aaliyah is such a great character. That whole concept of a child being imbued with all the knowledge of this entire clan of religious female
from
zealots.
From the moment of birth, yeah.
Witchy. And in the book, actually, it's terrifying. She comes out of her mother and within 10 minutes is speaking to people. Yeah, creepy. Creepy! They left that out.
Right. Yeah, well, they skipped over a whole, 2-year period with 30 seconds of voiceover from Paul, so... You know.
They tried.
But that battle at the end, when they're all riding the worms...
Yeah!
And it's great, and yes, Patrick Stewart's there again, and, you know, it's all wonderful. But the thing that made... the thought that came to mind for me was, who was it who first figured out how you ride a worm? Like, what was that person trying to do?
I'm sure there. It must be. It's been a very long time since I read the books, but I bet that's in there. So bizarre. It just none of it really makes any sense, but it does at the same time.
Well, I think it does. This is the thing. It does make sense. And this is, again, something that the critics of it at the time, a lot of them said it was incoherent or just way too complicated for anybody to understand. And I don't think that's true at all. I think that's another classic example of people assuming that because it's sci-fi, they don't have to pay attention.
Yeah.
And then when they suddenly find they haven't been paying attention and therefore don't know what's going on, they dismiss it not as their problem, but as the movie's fault for being incoherent.
Right. I mean, and then you have the critics that were just merciless about it. I mean, Ebert hated it. I remember seeing him rant and rave about how much he hated it. the New York Times panned it.
That's the other thing. I hadn't realized how... I mean, I knew that it was kind of seen as a weird movie that, you know, was a bit strange and a bit of a weird thing in David Lynch's career. I knew that the purists didn't like it because it strayed so far from the books. But I didn't realize just how much it really is maligned and derided by everyone. I had no idea.
Hates it. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those movies where I will confess to not just enjoying it, but loving it. And, you know, a majority of the like-minded individuals give me a look like I just farted. But then there's always that one or two people whose eyes light up and they start rattling off quotes and we just go into this reverie of Dune appreciation together.
Yeah. Well, and I am definitely one of those people.
Yes.
Because I like you, I genuinely love this movie. And I had actually forgotten how much I love it until watching it again. This will amuse you. You know who else loves it? Mutual friend of ours, Will Wheaton.
Oh, hell yeah.
And I know that because,
Will!
Sorry, Will, if you're listening, Will was actually, he said if he came back, he was going to do this movie.
Oh, sorry, I stole your thunder, Will. Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah, that makes sense. I really enjoyed listening to you two geek out about the original Tron. Or no, yes, it was the original Tron.
It was the original Tron. Yeah, that was fun.
That
but
was
yeah, I genuinely love this movie.
Yeah.
And as I say, I had no idea until I started looking into it in preparation for this show that it was so derided.
Absolutely. It was completely torn to shreds. David Lynch was torn to shreds. Everyone who worked on it had this hangdog sort of feel for, apparently, like, everyone was just so devastated walking away from this and just beaten down.
Which is such a shame.
It really, it makes me so sad, and I'm so grateful that this thing exists. I'm grateful that the activity book series exists. We haven't talked about that. We need to talk about that very quickly.
All right, go on, tell us about it.
So there is actually a full, like, there's five or six activity books in a series made for children, based on this world, because the marketing people were just so desperately trying to market it as a kind of Star Wars vehicle. And you can still find them on Amazon. And I wrote a great big piece about it on Coil House. And it's called The Franchised Goodies for the Children of Dune.
Yeah, I will link to it in the show notes.
Please do. Yeah. That was one of my prouder, nerdier moments on the blog, that one. No, I mean, these really were genuinely made for, with the express purpose of trying to get children interested. There's a no-bake spice cookies recipe.
Yeah.
We had a screening a while back at a friend's place, and a bunch of us showed up, and a friend of mine that does a lot of trimming, if you know what I mean.
Right.
He brought special no-bake spice cookies.
And with his very own blend of spice melange.
Indeed. The spice extends life.
He who controls the spice controls the universe.
Controls the universe. Indeed.
Okay, we're just getting into this area now where we're just quoting lines back at one another. So let's bring this to a close.
I had to work so hard not to be doing that the entire time.
Oh, I know. Well, there are some movies that are just so quotable.
She has
the weirding way.
I will kill him.
Yeah. Oh, God, yes.
Oh,
Sting.
That was one of those moments that made me realize that I liked
Skinny Englishman. Skinny, psychopathic Englishman.
In winged leather bikini briefs. Oh, yep. My God. Be still my something. Yep.
All right. And on that note,
it's been a pleasure.
Meredith, where can people find you if they like what you have to say?
Oh, okay. Well, I have a Twitter account. It's Theremina, Theremina. And then I have my musical projects that I'm working on. The parlortrick.com. I have a Tumblr, again, under Theremina, if you want to come say hi over there. I'm very much I'm all over Twitter and Tumblr, so I'm not hard to find.
And your Tumblr, I can assure readers, is well worth a follow, because it is full of some of the strangest things you have ever laid eyes upon. In a good way.
Well, thank you.
I mean that as a most sincere compliment.
I will take it as such. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Unjustly Maligned. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, please check out my comics, books, and music. For example, if epic sci-fi is your thing, you may enjoy my graphic novel series Wasteland, a post-apocalyptic mystery quest across a ruined America. Wasteland is available at your local comic or bookstore and at online retailers everywhere. Go to anthonyjohnston.com, where you'll find information and links to all of my work. Please also consider rating Unjustly Maligned on iTunes. It's the best way to spread the word about the show and is very much appreciated. Unjustly Maligned is a 7RQ production for The Incomparable and is made in England. You can find more information, links, and show notes at ump.fm. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Can you imagine if Kubrick had directed this? Oh my God.
Oh my God. Oh my God. That would have been amazing.
Now my head's exploding.
Ridley Scott also had a shot at this, and then he said no, and I believe that was when he made Alien.
Oh wow.
I think it may have been one of those things where Scott took a look at what a quagmire this was going to be and thought, how can I do something similar on a much smaller, more controlled and claustrophobic scale?
Right, because Alien is a much leaner movie, isn't it?
It is, but it still is such incredible storytelling and world building. And Alien to me is much like the Xenomorph itself, a perfect entity.
Sure.
And I can see, but I really do think somehow in some sort of, an osmosis sort of way, I think Scott must have grokked what was good and amazing about Dune and the Yoderowski visions of that.
Right. Yeah.
And he sort of was like, how can I make something more concise? And I think that's why Alien happened.
Yoderowski or Hodorowski?
I think it's Yoderowski.
Is that because you've watched this documentary and I haven't? Is that how they say his name in the
documentary? Hodorowski, Yoderowski. They definitely don't have a J sound. It's either Hodorowski or Yoderowski.
Right. But not definitive. Does he never say his own name?
I'm sure he does, but I don't recall. I'm kind of surprised
he doesn't talk about himself in the third person.
He may very well have. He does have that sort of Gary Busey thing going on, in a good way. In a good way. I love that man so much. Actually, one of the most proud moments that I have, as far as Coil House magazine goes, is we published a wonderful interview with him in one of our print magazines. And
wait, with Hodorowski or Gary Busey?
With that would have been good too. That would have been pretty good.
This is an incredibly white movie.
Oh,
isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, Jose Ferrer is as close to non-white as this movie gets.
Yeah, that's unfortunate. That's very unfortunate.
And many, many movies of the 80s have that problem, many sci-fi movies especially. You know, it's notable that there are, you know, 10 times more, 10 times the waiting water. No, that there are 10 times more non-white faces in the Star Wars prequels than in the original Star Wars movies, you know.
Yeah, it's rough. It's that is a part of that time period that I am glad has ended.
I mean, even in the, like, you see, for example, that beautiful matte painting where Paul is addressing the Fremen.
Yeah.
And they have, you know, a few real people moving around, and then the rest is all a massive painting. But it's beautiful. Like, all of the mats in this movie are fantastic. Mm-hmm. But I sort of paused the video and looked, and I was like, yep, they're all white faces. Like, every single one of them.
That is some mayo. The Fremen are some white people.
And it's had such a massive influence on sci-fi and
it really
pop culture.
Has. And nobody's been able to get to that level again. I mean, it's, you know, Blade Runner and Dune. Those are the two films everyone keeps trying to
repackage
visually and world building wise, and they just never get there. And you gotta give credit to Dune for that. Like that as much of a mess as it is, it got there. It did something.
Well, and it did create genuinely iconic visuals as well, like the sandworms, the still suits,
yes.
You know, the Mentats, the way they were depicted. So much of it is, well, and the Bene Gesserit, of course, so much of it is visually so striking and so memorable.
It is. And visually, I mean, it's on par with Star Wars. In a lot of ways, visually, in terms of elegance, it surpasses it. And, you know, again, it's just, it's a closer cousin to Kubrick than it is to Star Wars. And that's, again, worth giving credit where it's due. I'm alive! Like, woo!